So let's start with one that I have found shockingly applicable in so many areas. What if it's the name? The Patagonian toothfish is not the most appealing of dishes to order on the menu. So he makes up a new name. He calls it the Chilean sea bass. And
Wow.
boom, 1990s had a 30-fold increase alone.
Hey guys, welcome to the Brain and Brand Show. I'm Timothy Maurice. This is the show helping you understand the secrets of the brain and how these secrets can help you build influence, build brands, your leadership style, and create a competitive advantage for yourself and your business. Today, we're exploring the behavioral science secrets behind 17 of the world's best brands like Apple, Samsung. And I'll be doing this with Michael Aaron Flicker, who is the co-author of Hacking the Human Mind. Michael Aaron is not just a researcher and an author. He is a CEO and builds businesses. And it's through this lens of an entrepreneur that we look at five practical implications that you can use today of using behavioral science to grow your businesses and your influence. Meet Michael Aaron. Enjoy. Michael Aaron, welcome. How are you?
Timothy, thank you so much for having me. I'm great and I'm super excited to be with you today.
Yeah, you are a very unique guest. Typically, if I have a guest on, they have written a book and they're looking to go global. They're going to speak on the global stage. They're selling something, they're selling a course, they're consulting. But you're just a CEO, builds businesses as well. You've got a few businesses. And you just really want people to be empowered by the insights in this book.
When you're passionate about a topic, it's hard to not get animated and talk about it. And I think the industry, especially in the United States, marketing, advertising, can learn so much from behavioral science. And when I uncovered it and I started using it in my work, it changed the way I looked at everything, not just my work, but the way I shopped at the grocery store. And writing this book was a lot of fun. And I wanted to do it to help people make the industry better, hopefully make work more effective. And it's really a pleasure for me to do it. And I'm thrilled to chat about it with anybody who wants to talk to me.
Yeah. Well, let's give a shout out to your co-author, Richard Schatten. How is Richard doing? Do you guys speak often now that you've written this book together?
We, you know, Richard and I met about 4 years ago, and kind of from the first meeting, we were fast friends and buddies, and we came up with this idea to start the Consumer Behavior Lab, which is it's a nonprofit group that's made to help bring behavioral science to marketing. We started a little podcast together. And then we wanted to do more, so we decided to write the book together. But Richard's out of London, England. I'm out of New York City. So we have a across-the-pond friendship, and we get to see each other a bunch of times a year. We talk every week. It's, yeah, it's really nice to have a co-author and thought partner.
How is the lab doing?
You know, the lab is going great. We, as you kind of set it up, we exist to cover interesting topics, bring research that we're reading in academic journals to the brand marketers and advertisers. And you meet all sorts of people who find it interesting. And there's a lot bigger world that doesn't find it interesting at all. And that's fine. So we built this little community and it's been really rewarding. And so we've enjoyed it. Yeah.
But what's different about your work is that you provide a list of extraordinary case studies. And you open the book with one of my favorite, and certainly my parents' favorite down in North Carolina, this burger joint. But we're not going to go there yet. Before we do that, I want to go inside your mind in my favorite feature, where we ask you seven either-or questions to get to know you a little bit, to literally hack the CEO, to go behind the mask of this extraordinarily successful person who's now an author. Can we go inside your mind?
I welcome you in.
Here we go. Number one, iced tea or warm tea?
Warm tea.
Number two, printed, ebook, or audiobook?
Printed book.
Let me just say this, that this is about to get really tough. And I really want you to buckle up, settle in. I know New York is tough as a city, but this. Number three, Michael or Aaron?
Oh, if my mother is listening, Timothy, it has to be one word, no space with a capital A, but others call me just Michael.
Are you serious? I was actually going to ask you about that, Michael, Aaron. Because it's funny, because a lot of people call me Timothy Maurice. Maurice is my middle name, and people assume it's my double barrel first name.
And, you know, it's when you have a Timothy Maurice, when you have a Michael Aaron, sometimes that is the full thought. It's just not enough to have half. But it was the 1980s. My mother wanted Mike. My mother wanted Aaron. My dad wanted Michael. And they smashed them together. And that's how we got Michael Aaron.
Awesome. Number four, Apple or Samsung?
Apple, and I have a lot of respect for Samsung, but I live on the Apple ecosystem.
Yeah. Are you on an Apple device right now?
I am on, I think there's about four Apple devices within my hand's reach.
Awesome. Driving or Ubering?
Oh, Ubering. And my wife will tell you, Timothy Maurice, that I am a much better passenger than driver.
Number six, writing or reading?
I would say, I thought I was a reader, but I actually now believe that I read to write. So I'm going to go with writing on that
one. Mm, this is what I'm talking about. Guys, if you're listening carefully, this man is an author now. I mean, he has to own it.
I just got there, but I'm a brand new first time author. I just got there.
And number seven, and I can tell you now, if you answer this honestly, it's going to take you a second. Richard Chutton or Roy Sutherland? These are the RS effect. This is the RS effect.
Richard and I are big fans of Rory Sutherland. So he would support me in saying Rory Sutherland. Together we would say that.
Richard, if you're listening, I'm going to go with Rory as well. I don't know you, Richard. You seem cool in the book, but I'm going with Rory. Oh, man. Michael Aaron, thank you so much for allowing us to go inside your mind. The first thing I want to know is, when you guys were studying these 17 of the world's best brands, did you see yourself in some of your businesses in those brands?
You know, it's a really interesting question, because we've built a lot of the brands that Xenoside Ventures, my parent company, owns from almost a most important behavioral insight that we thought we could harness and use in the market. So in the brands that we've started, we start with the behavioral insight and then we build the brand. For the book, we went the other way. Let's look at the world's best brands. And can we find where they took advantage of a human insight, of something that was inside human nature, whether they knew the behavioral science or not? But could we find great examples that drove business outcomes and then deconstruct it? Can we share the academic research behind it? Nice. And then, most importantly, can we help everyone think about how to apply it to their business? Because it's just interesting conversation until you say, so this is what Aperol did. This is the science that proves why it works. And this is how you can use it at home. So every chapter follows the same model, but it's a little different than how I've done it with my own brands.
I have to tell you, there's a bunch of these type books, but this is unique because you followed that particular model. And I really... when I received this request and I got a chance to finally sit down and read this book, I just smiled and I just thought to myself, damn it, why did I not think of this?
That's very generous of you. And you know, the thing we were worried about was, you don't want to pretend like that's the whole reason for the brand's success. You don't want, you know, like, it's not it's not the entire reason why Apple is Apple. Sure. But it did have a real connection with the people because of the behavioral science behind it, and we can learn from that. So we're not saying that they're best brands because of behavioral science. We're saying they were successful so we can learn from them. And it's a shortcut for all of us to do better work in the market. If we can learn from others that were successful, learn on their dime, then we could do better because of that.
Yeah, this is probably the second product that I've engaged where I was just jealous. The other one is the podcast Business Wars. I mean, that podcast is brilliant, right? Because that's where I learned about Five Guys, I think. I mean, he looked at these kind of burger business and the wars that happened in the burger business. And you guys started with Five Guys and telling the story of where the children were given the option of going to college or just running with the business. And I was just like, this is brilliant. This is brilliant because, you know, the fact that they got fries and the simplicity of fries in the burger right. At any point when you were looking at this, were you surprised even at just how, like, were you having these moments?
Without doubt. And the Five Guys example is one of those so counterintuitive examples that you say to yourself, wait, so much of marketing and advertising doesn't follow this. Could this really be true? Would it be helpful if I summarize for everybody just super quickly what that insight is? So as Timothy said, Jerry Murrell and his four sons, these guys become the Five Guys, are thinking about whether their oldest will go to college or does he want to take the challenge to start a business. They're on a Maryland boardwalk and they're looking at all the food stands. And only one of them has this massive line. And the massive line is for Thrasher fries. And as Timothy said, they only sell one thing. They sell just French fries, not fish and chips, not burgers and fries. They have one thing. And Jerry has this human insight. What if because they only sell one thing, they're more believable? People see them as higher quality because that's all they do. And this is the human insight that behavioral scientists call the gold dilution effect. That if you say that you're good at multiple things, you overall are less believable. And there's an amazing, many amazing studies. We talk about Ayelet Fishbach from the University of Chicago study that if it's interesting, I can go into it. But the point is, the more benefits that you list, the less believable they all are together. And that's really important for marketers and brand advertisers because you get a brief and you want to talk about how the car goes fast and looks good. And by the way, it's as comfortable as your bed. But by focusing on so many, we actually are less believable than if we just focused on one thing that we would do better than anyone else. So it is real application in this.
Yeah. And, you know, my listeners will be fairly aware of most of these behavioral science effects. And, you know, I think for me, what I want to explore. Yeah. In fact, I know what I want to explore was your relationship with these effects as you're learning them as well. Because what's interesting, I would have loved to interview Richard as well. And maybe we'll have him on as a part two of this series. But I'm very much interested in you as a CEO, as you're learning about these effects. I mean, a lot of this was probably you already knew, but having a frame for it, like scarcity, for example, I want to know how you started to apply many of these effects. So let's choose three that you've really found rewarding. And, you know, I want to promote this book. I think the thing I love most about having this podcast is that people actually do go and buy these books. And so, guys, if you please make a note right now, Hacking the Human Mind, the Behavioral Science Secrets Behind 17 of the World's Best Brands. These secrets, as Michael Aaron has said, you can apply these right now and radically change the outcomes of your business. So let's talk about you, Michael Aaron, and what you have been learning, a few of them. If you want to go past three, that's okay. And you can feel free to reference the case studies and so forth as well.
Okay. So let's start with one that I have found shockingly applicable in so many areas. It was probably one of the most jarring discoveries in the whole book. And so I'm going to tell a very quick story. It's the late 1970s, And there's a American fish importer named Lee Lance. And he's got this new fish that America's never tasted before. And he's confident that if he could get it into restaurants, it would take off like crazy. But he's selling it, and no restaurateurs are bringing in. And he can't understand it. This amazing, white, meaty, but a little bit flaky fish. It should work. And then he realizes, what if it's the name? The Patagonian toothfish is not the most appealing of dishes to order on the menu. So he makes up a new name. He calls it the Chilean sea bass. And boom, 1990s had a 30-fold increase alone. We're talking about the power of names here. And the fish industry is chock full of them. In America, for many years, there was a fish called the dolphin fish. But in America, it conjured up images of Flipper, a friendly dolphin. So they rebranded it as Mahi Mahi. And all of a sudden, it's in tacos. Mud bug linguine does not sound appetizing, but crawfish linguine or crayfish linguine sounds great. And this idea that the word itself can, just in the name, can make a big impact feels kind of hyperbolic. So 1974, Elizabeth Loftus and John Palmer at the University of Washington, and they have a very famous academic study where they show a clip of a car crash. They ask everybody to watch the clip of the car crash and estimate how fast the car was moving when it crashed. But here's the twist in the experiment. Sometimes they ask, how fast was the car going when it contacted the wall? Sometimes they say hit or bumped or collided or smashed. And the difference between, and all they're doing is estimating the same exact video of the car, 27% faster if you say how fast was the car going when it smashed the wall versus how fast was it going when it contacted the wall. They go from 32 miles per hour to 40 miles per hour, a big change. And so it just underscores the point that every word it matters when someone's thinking about what they're choosing or what they're doing. It has big implications in the American legal system. If somebody's on the stand and it's the word you use in questioning them, has big implications in brand marketing. And I think I didn't appreciate just how every word, one verb, can make a big difference. So I think that was the first big discovery for me.
But that effect, what is that effect called again?
We call that, what do we call that effect? That's good. What's the bias name? We called it on ours, we just called it the power of naming. But let me see if.
Let's just call it the naming effect.
Yeah.
Naming framing effect.
Yes.
And the first one was the goal. What was it? The goal driven.
Goal dilution effect.
Dilution.
Dilution.
Got it. We got the goal dilution.
Too many goals dilute the effect.
Yep. Got goal dilution. We got naming effect. You know what's fascinating is I'm blown away. I have been gripped throughout my career about the power of names, and it's nice to have a nice frame for this. If you think about so many celebrities have one name, Tiger, Serena. It's so many. It's like the sheer power of having a unique name, I think, hacks your own mind to make you feel like you're unique, right? And if you think about so many celebrities like Jon Stewart, his real name, his surname is actually Leibowitz. Like Leibowitz, welcoming Jon Stewart Leibowitz, it just doesn't ring well. And I didn't know that about the seafood. This is beautiful, beautiful insight. I actually think I start using Timothy Maurice because I just think it sounds better than Webster. And I think Michael Aaron sounds kind of cool and sexy as well, right? It's like,
thank you.
Yes. Yeah, names. And I actually, it's funny because I think some cars are struggling to sell because their names aren't cool. Who wants to say I've got some weird, you know, name for a car that I drive? And if you think about Mercedes has a particular, it's got swag to it, right?
Without doubt. And I think it goes even beyond like a cultural insight that it feels cool or not cool. I don't know if you and your listeners have heard of this study, Bulba and Kiki, which is this idea that the rounding of the sounds infer something about what it is. When I started a compression sock brand, a bamboo premium compression sock brand named Wello Socks. But I chose the word Wello, and all the branding is against yellow because we wanted people to get this feeling that the word was soft. No hard consonants, everything is soft. So when you say, I wear Wello socks, we're implying the softness, even if you don't consciously know it. So I think you're right. Mercedes has something about it that it just feels smooth and quick. It doesn't have any hard consonants. Yeah. And so this is the Bulba Kiki effect that I've read about before.
All right. So we'll attach that particular effect to the second insight for this that you're sharing with us. All right. Yes. So that spell that the Bulba Kiki effect.
Yeah, I'll spell it for you. Bulba is B-O-U-B-A and Kiki, okay. K-I-K-I.
All right. We want to roll.
And the study, you know, we can pull the data on the study, but the study across 25 different languages, everybody across cultures think the same thing when they hear Kiki versus Bulba. It means the same thing regardless of your language. That's the insight that it cuts across culture. So it's really a very cool study.
Got it. Wow. All right. We're on a roll. We've got two powerful insights. Let's see if we can get to five. And we'll wrap up this conversation and people can go and get the book. Because the book is available on ebook as well, right? So people can download it anywhere, but if it's not available in your country. I know some of the podcasts you've been on, my podcast listened to in 33 countries. Melina, I think she's in over 100 countries. Yeah. And so in your country, you may not have this book, but you can certainly get it online. What is the number three extraordinary insight that you have that you either use or you want people to start using?
Yeah. This insight comes from Apple. And the insight that we saw kind of over and over again is that Apple has this way of bringing to life their products almost better than anyone else. And so the bias we're going to talk about today is concreteness. And the example from Apple that we use in the book that was so inspirational to me is the moment that Steve Jobs releases the iPod. And he goes up on stage and he holds up this little device. And rather than every other MP3 player in the market that said 5 gigabytes of storage, high quality sound, he holds it up and he says, imagine 1,000 songs in your pocket. Mm. And he's taking advantage of this human insight that if I can see it in my mind, it's going to stick with me longer. It's going to penetrate my mind better. And this comes from a study that was done in 1972 by Ian Begg. And here's the very interesting study. He recruits 25 different people, and he reads them a list of two-word phrases. I'll give you a few of them. Impossible amount, rusty engine, white horse, subtle fault. And then he finishes the list of 22 word phrases and he says, how many can you remember? And on average, people remember 23% of the terms. Okay, pretty good. But here's the insight that Begg has. People remember just 9% of the abstract phrases, like impossible amount, versus 36% of the phrases that are concrete terms, like white horse. It's a fourfold increase. If we can get you to imagine the word in your mind, you are four times more likely to remember it. And this has a big effect. Think about some of the most powerful taglines in America. Red Bull gives you wings. You can see it. M&M's melts in your mouth, not in your hand. You see it. Skittles, you can taste the rainbow. You see it. Maxwell House coffee, good to the last drop. Some of the most effective brand advertising puts a picture in your mind. And that's really important because so much of what we want to sell is sophistication, perfection. Mm. Those are hard to imagine. So if you can draw a picture, it can be much more effective. And once I learned this, I couldn't unlearn it. I stopped talking in abstracts and I started talking in concrete phrases that you can imagine. And that's been very effective for me and my career and my work. And so that one I've really used a lot.
You know, what's crazy is I'm thinking about, there are times when I'm on stage and I flop. And then there are times when I get it right. And I think the days I get it right is when I use this particular insight. When people can see it, when I can simplify speaking about neuroscience or behavioral science in a way where people go, oh, recently I had a moment in where the audience was like, there was like this moment of like, oh, like there's a moment where, and I was telling a specific story and it just hit me that that was the particular tool. And if you are intentional about using this tool, and I really want people to go back and do a simple imagination audit. I actually want people to go look at your work, look at what you may be potentially struggling in your work, and ask yourself, is there too much abstract language? Is it possible? Because that's it. I mean, this is so powerful. 1,000 songs in your pocket, particularly coming from that CD period, people are going, imagine 1,000. Okay, how many CDs is that in my pocket?
Exactly.
It's incredible, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think it hits on something that, there's another behavioral science insight called the generation effect. If you have somebody help you complete, if they complete the thought, it's more sticky. This is like a close cousin to it. If I can get you to think about it in your own brain and imagine it, I'm part of the activity. I'm not just receiving information. I'm building the idea with you. And that's going to be more memorable. And so I think you're right. If you can get them to think, well, how many CDs is that? You've already won. You're already more effective. And so you really make a deeper connection with people when you have them drawing things in their mind, thinking about it in their own way.
Yeah. You know, China has a $80 billion soft power fund. Because I think what they realize is that the world doesn't really have a clear way to relate to it. You know, when you think about New York, you think about a city that doesn't sleep. Like you can imagine being out at 3 a.m. If I go to Shanghai, I don't actually know what to imagine, right? And if I can increase the soft power in people's minds, I can attract people for tourism, investment, et cetera. So what we're speaking about in terms of hacking people's minds is creating more soft power in people's minds, right?
Without doubt. And one of the things that Richard and I reflected on quite a bit when we do our podcast and when we do our book is these tricks don't get anybody to do anything. What they do is they reveal a part of human nature so that you can work with it rather than against it. It's hard enough to get people to buy, get people to stop smoking. It's hard enough as it is. But if you cannot work against human nature, it's more likely your work's going to be effective. And that's really what we're talking about. We're giving you insights to be more effective. It doesn't mean it's going to work, but it means it's going to be more likely to work.
All right. You got two more, but before we go to your other two, are you intrigued by how Starbucks is grappling with their identity at the moment? Because let me tell you, I cannot believe this Starbucks moment of them having, trying to figure out if they're going to be a Frappuccino milkshake company or a refined espresso with beautiful espresso where so few people are interested in espresso, but tons of young girls want to go buy Frappuccinos and laugh. Like, are you you guys did a case study. Tell me what you're thinking about this Starbucks moment right now.
You know, the Starbucks moment is super interesting because the creation of the brand was the DNA of the brand was Howard Schultz's vision that he could bring a little bit of Italy to America. And he names the sizes, Venti and Trenta. Yes. You know, he tries to infuse the idea. I believe it's Starbucks that brings the macchiato to America. So he has this idea that he's going to bring Italian culture. And in the original Starbucks, as they play classical Italian music on the speakers to set the scene.
Yes.
But 38,000 stores globally, they're a quick service restaurant. And what does quick service restaurants want? It wants speed. It wants convenience. It wants customization. The newest CEO, Brian, I'm going to forget his last name. The newest CEO said, the biggest problem we have is that the app destroys the customer experience because you push a few buttons and you want to show up and have it done. There's no experience in the store. Now that's two sides of a very long spectrum. Are we a craft coffee house or are we a mass drink shop? And really there's it's an identity moment. You're right to call it out that they're grappling with their identity. Another company that I've started is this company called Fizz District, Timothy, and it's a concept store in Louisville, Kentucky. And our whole vision is, can we make better for you drinks, healthier for you soda, to teach a generation to not just want sweet drinks, but to want it made from whole fruit, whole ingredients. And it's been a fascinating experience. We've been open 11 months. Yeah, I'm an entrepreneur. I this is what we do. We make things. Fascinating thing is, they can love the drinks. 5-star reviews. They think the experience is great. But if you don't have enough transactions, it doesn't matter. So if you're not in a high enough thoroughfare, not enough, it's really hard to make the model work. And I think that that's my own personal connection to Starbucks's giant global problem.
It
doesn't matter if you're great at making espresso that takes 7 minutes a cup, if you can't do the transaction volume you need to make the whole concept make money. So it's a fascinating tension between what people want and how you can deliver it.
I was thinking about, I actually would love a call with Brian. I think his surname is Nichols. And I've been thinking I've been thinking about Brian's tension. And I've been, you know, if they separated the brand, would that help or would that cause more problems? Because I know in South Africa, for example, they have, I think that's the case in New York as well. Somewhere in New York, there's like a few reserve locations where for the people who want those. But I don't think the average person cares. I think people just walk into Starbucks and go, I'm going to order this thing on my app. And it's anyway. So, you know, thinking about I'm only bougie in one thing in my life, Michael Aaron, and that is coffee. Like I have flown to Italy for literally espresso tasting. Like literally, you know, when I found out that the Americano, do you know the story about how the Americano came about?
No, please tell us.
Yeah. So this is interesting. During World War II, obviously Americans, we couldn't, you know, we struggled with such a strong coffee. So the Italians were like, just add the water and for the Americans and give them the Americano version. So they couldn't take a stronger espresso. That's where it comes from. Soldiers could not take proper coffee. It kind of sums up the American experience, right? We water down things and then scale it.
Make it a commercial success.
Yeah, right? Anyway, and whatever that effect is, we need to grapple with that. Like maybe you guys in your consumer lab, how do you take something original like the Italian experience that's difficult to scale because it's slow, and then we add a bit of a flavor and an effect to it to scale it. I don't know what that effect is called, but we'll leave that out there for you guys listening and for Michael Aaron's lab. Number four, what is the fourth kind of insight that you want to apply that you've seen that really struck you?
So this one we call the expectation assimilation. And the brand that taught us this better than almost any other was Kraft Macaroni and Cheese. So here's the situation. It's the late 2010s. And Kraft Mac and Cheese has made a decision to remove artificial colors and preservatives from their macaroni and cheese. But they have an insight. They might have not known the behavioral science, but they have an insight. We make a formula change. If we make a recipe change, it may not do well in the market. And so they come up with this campaign and they call it the world's largest blind taste test. They sold 50 million boxes of Kraft macaroni and cheese. They sell a million boxes a day. So for 50 days, they sold it under the new formulation, but they didn't advertise it. And when they announce it, they say, thank you for participating in the world's largest blind taste test, and you all loved it. And what they were doing with was they were trying to make sure that just because it got healthier for you, people didn't think it tasted worse. And they had this instinct that by removing the artificial colors and preservatives, that people would be worried it wouldn't taste as good. Mm. And this is backed up by some really interesting science. So the study that we use comes out of Austin McComb School of Business. And they run a study where they give guests at a party an Indian yogurt drink called the Mango Lassi. In Austin in 2006, that was not a well-known drink. And they allowed researchers to explore the reaction, the initial reaction to a new experience. So half the guests were told that the lassis were primarily healthy. And the other half, the guests were told that this is an indulgent drink. It's primarily unhealthy. And then they were asked a single question, rate whether you like the drink or not. And the results teach us this insight. Those who believe the drink to be unhealthy rated it as 55% more tasty than those that thought it was good for them. Same drink, same tasting. Only the question is it a healthy for you drink or a not healthy for you drink? So our expectations guide what your experience will be. That's why we call it the expectation assimilation. Because if you think what's going to be, it will change the way you taste, smell, or see. And so that's really that was really a big change for
me. That's a powerful one. Yeah. That's really powerful. Because you can imagine Kraft. If they had come out and said, we're going to change and make it healthy for you, the business could have crumbled. Literally could have crumbled. And you know what's funny? It's like, I'm a vegan. I don't really say this because I want people to know. People say, how do you know if somebody's a vegan, they'll tell you. I'm not one of those. But I do believe this, Michael Aaron, that vegan is in a way, the word vegan and healthy and plant-based is in the way of people eating the food. I've seen so many times I've tricked people in my home where I invite them over and I serve them a meatball pasta and they enjoy it until they, you know, find out it's vegan. And then they start questioning whether or not it was good. They loved it.
And of course, after the fact that they already liked it. They loved it.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I believe whoever is driving this, in fact, this Michelin star restaurant in New York that was like number one in the world and we end up going, what's the name of it? They end up going
11
vegan.
Madison Park. 11 Madison Park became a fully vegetarian. Go ahead.
Yeah. And now they're going back to meat because I genuinely think it was a labeling naming challenge. There's so much application to this work. This is beautiful. And this is why I really got excited about having this conversation with you guys because, you know, I think whether it's your personal life, whether it is family, you can apply this everywhere, right?
That's right. That's right. It's got a lot of effect in if you're a white collar professional and you're trying to convince someone of your ideas at work, if you're in your family and you're trying to change the way someone feels about something, you know, they're going to come in with biases. If you can work with those biases, you're much more likely to get where you want to go rather than working against them. So, I mean, that's really the takeaway from expectation assimilation.
I'd like to just wander a little bit and we'll wrap this up in the next couple of minutes. But, you know, the diamond industry is struggling right now. The diamond industry had this effect associated to it that there was a strong correlation between people wanting to have a marriage that was forever and diamonds being known for being able to withstand whatever and last forever. Now that people don't really want to be together forever, diamonds don't have a place. People are like, I don't want to be with you forever. You know, I want a fluid relationship. I don't even know if I want to be a person forever. Maybe I want to be a duck or maybe I want to be something else. People don't even want to be themselves forever. And so if you were consulting diamonds, what would you say to De Beers and the big diamond players?
I would say that there is real a power in nostalgia. And so if you can tap into the idea of something that has served your grandparents and your great grandparents and harkens back to a happier, simpler time, you can reach a large portion of the world that want to return to that better time. And by putting on a diamond every day, it maybe just reminds you of when life was a little bit simpler. But I think you're right, Timothy. I don't know that you can win the argument you were going down. I don't know that you're going to change that about people. So I would probably take a different tack. That's just what a marketing guy might do. I might fight a different fight rather than try to win the one you were going down.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about it, maybe it's your diamond is not meant to be worn every day. Maybe it's the day that you need to feel that sense of foreverness, that day.
There you go. Right? Yeah, I love that. That's beautiful. Yeah.
The last one I wanted to run by you real quick, because I know we need to wrap, is I actually think America is grappling with a brand challenge at the moment. I really genuinely think the brand America, the American dream, is under threat. And we won't answer this on this particular podcast, but somebody, and maybe you guys can study it in your lab, somebody needs to bring a few politicians to the lab and go, guys, let's apply behavioral science to get some of these policies through that are complex and difficult. Maybe we can accelerate the decision-making process in Congress and so forth. I really feel we need to have our politicians' minds hacked. They need to read this book.
Well, we would love for them to read the book, and we would love to help. Here's what I think. America, before it can worry about its global persona, is grappling with what it wants to be itself.
Yeah.
Is it a force for global good, or is it about itself first and foremost? And there is hot, deep debate within the country I'm sitting in right now about where the right place to put the future is. It's hard to ignore the trends of how the wealthiest Americans have amassed more and more wealth, and those that have the least are a larger and larger part of the population. Those numbers are fact. But what you do with that is now a matter of political persuasion. What you do with that, it really divides the country almost equally. Look how close the elections are. 50% or just a little bit less are on one side and 50% on the other side. And I think you're right, Timothy. If we could be more thoughtful about what we want to be, then we can get more clear about the message we want to have.
All right, well, let's wrap. What's your final effect that's blown your way?
I think I'm going to choose one that's a little out there. So I'm going to take you through this story, and you tell me if it strikes you as unique as it struck me. So the behavioral bias is called the peak end rule. And it's discovered, as you're familiar with Daniel Kahneman's work on the peak end rule. And what always struck me was where he first discovered this. So it's 1993. Kahneman and Donald Rademeyer are running a trial against actual colonoscopy patients. And basically the trial is every 60 seconds in the procedure, you're going to rate the pain that you feel on a scale. I think it's of 1 to 10, maybe it's 1 to 13. Anyway, they're rating the scale and they are recording how they feel. And then after the study is over, they ask them to go back and rate the pain that they felt. And they asked them to rate it, I think, at the end of the experience and then with time after. And what they found was after it was over, there was no correlation to the actual pain that throughout the entire procedure, but rather it correlated far better to two moments, the peak of the intensity and the end of the procedure. And it was an insight that humans are not such great reporters of the truth. They're better reporters of the difference, the peak and the end. And why this was so striking to me was because we have so much energy and effort in business of trying to create the best overall user experience or the best hotel experience or the best dining experience, where humans will remember after really the peak moment and how you left them when you were done. And if we can put more energy and more effort into those two moments without creating a bad experience everywhere else, we could be much more effective. And I'm interested in how that affects brands and companies, but it makes a big difference in our personal life too. You know, you may not remember all of the moments with your brother, your loved one, but you're going to remember the peak moment of that day, and you're going to remember how you left them at the end of the day. And if we want to be more effective, if we want to be better remembered, if we focus on those, we're working with human nature. That was a big one for me, but you're familiar with the study, Timothy.
No. Well, it's not about me. I mean, this is a powerful insight. And I've been thinking about, you know, as you are speaking about each one of these insights, my mind races to an experience. And my experience that I'd never thought about until you shared this was in these long haul airline flights, where one of the peak moments is when they serve food, right?
Without doubt.
If you're on a 6, 7, 8 hour flight, and they decide to be nasty about how they serve you food, or they don't have your choice, you got to think through those things, airlines, I'm telling you. And then at the very end, how you walk off the plane. I think Roy Sutherland talks a lot about this, that if you slide up to the gate and you get off and you enter the airport versus getting on a bus, that end of that flight experience can be horrible. So listen, thank you very much. And I appreciate the work. I appreciate the fact that you're one of the most authentic people I've ever had on my podcast in 12 years. And the reason being is because you apply this in your work and you're not trying to sell it. You're not trying to get me to book you. You know, typically I ask people at the end of the podcast, where can we find you? You know, at the end of the day, all you really want is people to go get Hacking the Human Mind, the Behavioral Science Secrets Behind 17 of the World's Best Brand, and learn how to apply it to make your life better. And I thank you, and really, you know, give Rich a shout out. I appreciate you guys, and I don't take these moments for granted. And I am super, super grateful that you make time out of your business schedule, creating businesses and helping businesses thrive, to have this conversation with me. So I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on, Timothy. It was a really lovely conversation.
Guys, please go get this book and share it with someone. I always ask people to buy this book for themselves and somebody you care about who you think could take advantage of this conversation.